The affair Boris Pasternak has an interest for us as Jews, quite apart of its universal interest. Boris Pasternak is the first Jew to receive the Nobel Prize for Literature. Jews have been awarded many Nobel Prizes, in fact, far beyond what their numbers would justify. But nearly all of them have been in the fields of physics and chemistry and medicine, fields, with the exception of medicine, wherein Jews have not been credited heretofore with excellence. It would be most gratifying to be able to say that Boris Pasternak is an active and loyal Jew. He is not. He is an assimilated Jew, almost far beyond recognition, far beyond what his father was in the first period of his life. Boris' father was the eminent Jewish painter Leonid Pasternak, born in the Ukraine, reared in Odessa, studied art in Germany, and was professor in the Moscow School of Art. Leonid Pasternak left Russia soon after the Communist Revolution and settled in Berlin. And when the Nazis came to power in Germany, he moved to England, where he died in 1945. And during his many years as professor of art in Moscow, Leonid Pasternak had very little contact with his fellow Jews. And those were, as you will recall, hard and terrible years for the Jews of Russia, years of persecution and oppression. But Leonid Pasternak lived detached from them and did not share either their fate or their struggles. And this, you may recall, was a rather common attitude which was taken by Jewish artists and musicians and writers and intellectuals generally, both in the East and in the West, in those years and for a long time thereafter. Their own people knew them not, even when they did not actually deny, as some of them did, their Jewish origin. They were simply not in touch with them, with their own people. They stood aloof and detached. It was only after Leonid Pasternak fled from Bolshevik Russia and settled in Berlin that as an uprooted Jew, he sought out his brethren. Republican Berlin in those days after the First World War was the mecca of many transplanted Jews and a very active Jewish cultural life developed there. And here Leonid met many prominent Jews. Many of them identified with the movement for Jewish Renaissance and for the rebirth of Israel. And he moved in their circle, lived among them, painted their portraits. Chaim Nachum Bialik, Albert Einstein, Nachum Sokolov, Saul Chernyakhovsky, and Chaim Weizmann. And Leonid also later on wrote a book on Rembrandt and the Jews. In 1924, he visited Palestine. And on that occasion, the eminent Hebrew poet Chaim Nachman Bialik wrote, "Indeed, this man was slow in coming to us, but he has finally come, and he is welcome." And Bialik then proceeds to indict that entire generation of Jewish intellectuals and artists, of whom Leonid Pasternak was one, who made themselves alien to their own people, who thought that their ancestral home was too narrow and too confined for their talents and careers, and who offered up all their fine gifts of mind and spirit on every altar, save the altar of their own people. Their own people that gave them birth, and perhaps also their great endowments. "They belong," said Chaim Nachman Bialik, "to a dor shel shmad haruach, a generation of spiritual apostates. To this generation belonged this artist, who I'm now calling, perhaps for the first time in his life," said Bialik, "by his Hebrew name, Avraham Yitzchak Leib, the Reb Yosef Pasternak." Now it could be readily assumed that Leonid did not give his son Boris, who was destined to become the winner of the Nobel Prize, that he did not give Boris any Jewish upbringing or any basic Jewish loyalties. He did not. Boris is hardly distinguishable as a Jew in his writings. The cast of his ideas, his very phraseology, his metaphors and his similes, are those of a pious Christian mystic. He has little to say about God, but much to say about Christ. Many of his poetic themes, and Boris, of course, is preeminently a poet, many of his poetic themes are borrowed from the Gospel and the New Testament. And every gospel incident and phrase is idealized and exalted. In his book, Dr. Zhivago, Boris Pasternak refers here and there to the Jewish people, but always to point out that they have no reason or justification to survive as a people. It is evidently quite proper for the 150-odd nationality groups in the Soviet Union to survive and to retain their own language and culture, but not so the Jewish people. They should commit, according to Boris Pasternak, cultural and religious genocide and disappear in the Christian society about them. It's all right for Boris now to proclaim to the world how inextricably tied up he is with Russia, how he cannot leave. If forced to leave Russia, how much he loves his motherland. But it's all wrong for Jews to entertain such sentiments of deep national loyalty. He describes somewhere in his book, the incident of Cossacks playing with an old Jew and making sport of him during the First World War in one of the villages in the Pale of Settlement. And what delight they took in torturing that poor man. And the only conclusion which Boris Pasternak draws from that incident, of which of course he does not approve, is the following. Well now, what more perfect example can you have of the victims of this mentality than the Jews? Their national ideas forced them century after century to be a nation and nothing but a nation, and they have been chained to this deadening task all through the centuries when the rest of the world was being delivered from it by a new force which has come out of their own midst. Isn't it extraordinary? How can you account for it? Just think, this glorious holiday, referring to Christmas, this liberation from the curse of mediocrity, this soaring flight above the dullness of the humdrum existence, was first achieved in their land, proclaimed in their language, and belonged to their race. And they actually saw and heard it and let it go. How could they allow a spirit of such overwhelming power and beauty to leave them? How could they think that after it triumphed and established its reign, one wonders whether Christianity did triumph and establish its reign in the Soviet Union. They would remain as the empty husk of that miracle they had repudiated. What use is it to anyone, this voluntary martyrdom? Whom does it profit? For what purpose are these innocent old men and women and children, all these subtle, kind, humane people mocked and beaten up throughout the centuries? Why didn't the intellectual leaders of the Jewish people ever go beyond facile Weltschmerz and ironical wisdom? Why have they not, even if at the risk of bursting like boilers with the pressure of their duty, disbanded this army, which keeps on fighting and being massacred nobody knows for what? Why don't they say to them, come to your senses, stop. Don't hold on to your identity. Don't stick together, disperse. Be with all the rest. You are the first and best Christians in the world. You are the very things against which you have been turned by the worst and weakest among you. Well, I suspect that if Boris Pasternak may, because of the pressures to which he is being subjected now and the persecution, if he should ever be forced to leave the Soviet Union as was his father, he will probably then seek out his brothers in the land of his exile, like his father did, and they will welcome him as they did his father. And he may then come to learn what his father failed to teach him, why the Jewish people have survived, and the true meaning of their checkered and heroic career through history. Boris' father, Leonid, was a great friend of Count Leo Tolstoy. He visited him frequently, painted numerous portraits of him, illustrated Tolstoy's immortal work, Resurrection, and was greatly influenced by the teachings of this extraordinary mystic and pacifist, who derived his inspiration from the founder of Christianity. And undoubtedly, Leonid transmitted to his son his admiration for Tolstoy. And here, perhaps, lies one of the keys to an understanding of Boris Pasternak and of his monumental work, Dr. Zhivago, which has aroused such a storm in the Soviet Union. Tolstoy, you will recall, was himself not a revolutionist in any political sense, yet he too aroused the wrath of the Tsarist dictatorship in his day. He did not attack the Tsarist regime any more than Boris Pasternak attacked the Soviet regime. But the moral and spiritual integrity of Tolstoy's work, the stress which he laid upon the autonomy of the human spirit, upon the dignity of the individual, be he of the humblest, upon goodness and compassion, upon obedience to God's eternal law of justice and love, these were a constant threat to a Tsarist regime which was based on oppression and cruelty, on the knout, on the Cossack sabre, and on Siberian exile. And the same elements in Dr. Zhivago brought down upon Boris Pasternak the wrath of the new dictatorship which succeeded the Tsarist, and for the same reasons. In this book, Pasternak did not write any political tract exposing the evils of communism in practice, as did, for example, the Yugoslavian Gilas, who is today atoning for this crime in some prison in Yugoslavia. Pasternak did not even write a novel like that of Dudintsev's Not by Bread Alone, which is a severe indictment of the bureaucracy which has developed under the communist regime. Boris is interested not in any political or economic apparatus or system. He is interested primarily in man and what systems and apparati do to man as a human being. He is not interested in the organizational man, only in the individual, in the glory and in the beauty and in the tragedy of human life. I repeat again, Boris is essentially a poet. Men have called him the foremost Soviet poet of this generation. He is a mystic. He is a lyrical romanticist, a spiritual romanticist, who has infinite compassion for all human suffering and sin and defeat, and an adoration for the grandeur of the human spirit, and an abiding faith in life, which to him is greater than all those who would try to reshape it. Dr. Zhivago has, for the spread of its canvas, the years 1903 to 1929. That is, these years in Russia, which included the revolution or the uprising of 1905, the First World War, the collapse of the Tsarist Empire, the Bolshevik Revolution, the Civil War, and all the horror and tragedy and blood of those dreadful years, during which time men attempted to establish a new society through force and violence. Dr. Zhivago is the life story of a physician and a writer who lived in Russia during these years of upheaval, who was a good man, not a very forceful man, who was an intellectual, who was not a fanatical idealist, who was not
dogmatically pro or con for this or that, and who was not committed at all to reshape the world. But he respects himself as a human being, as an individual, and he respects those virtues which a man requires to be self-respecting. And this doctor, writer, would like to find some island of quiet and security, some refuge for himself and his family in the midst of all this twirling and twisting and plunging world about him. And he goes to distant Siberia to find it. But he cannot. And he dies an unreconstructed human being, unreconciled, though not at all in active opposition to the changed order about him. He dies alone, but somehow one feels undefeated. A woman who loved him deeply through the turbulent years of war and of homelessness thus takes leave of him at his death. The riddle of life, the riddle of death, the enchantment of genius, the enchantment of unadorned beauty, yes, yes, these things were ours. But the small worries of practical life, things like the reshaping of the planet, these things, no thank you, they're not for us. In a sense, Dr. Zhivago is the biography of a whole generation. Russia, written by a man whose basic conviction that people must be drawn to good by goodness is clearly not derived from the works of Marx or Lenin or Stalin. In the course of his lengthy novel, rather discursive novel, one must have a great deal of patience to read it. One must have a great deal of patience to read Tolstoy's War and Peace. A novel singularly free of those sex motifs without which a modern American novel cannot be written. In the course of his lengthy novel, the author puts in the mouth of his characters certain comments, certain reflections, of which no orthodox or official communist can approve, and they have not approved of them. Thus, for example, he writes, "The fashion nowadays is all for groups and societies of every sort. Gregariousness is always the refuge of mediocrities, whether they swear by Soloviev or Kant or Marx. Only individuals seek the truth." And again, he writes, "It turns out that those who inspire the revolution aren't at home in anything except change and turmoil. They aren't happy with anything that's on less than a world scale. For them, transitional periods, worlds in the making, are an end in themselves. They aren't trained for anything else. They don't know anything except that. And do you know why these never-ending preparations are so futile? It's because these men haven't any real capacities. They are incompetent. Man is born to live, not to prepare for life. Life itself, the phenomenon of life, the gift of life, is so breathtakingly serious. And again in this book he writes, not as part of a tract, but usually as part of a conversation among the characters, and they're so numerous in this book, I think that collectivization was a very wrong measure and that it failed. Though the error could not be acknowledged, and to conceal the failure by every means that terrorism can suggest, it is necessary to make people learn not to think or to judge, forcing them to see things that do not exist and proving the contrary of what everyone can see. And again, Marxism is not sufficiently master of itself to be a science. I know of no current of thought that is more isolated and farther from the facts than Marxism. And this summary of what war and the revolution have done for home and family and the soul of the individual is most revealing and in a sense most devastating. We were married 2 years before the war, is one of the leading characters in the book. We were just beginning to make a life for ourselves. We had just set up our home when the war broke out. I believe now that the war is to blame for everything, for all the misfortunes that followed, that hound our generation to this day. I remember my childhood well. I can still remember a time when we all accepted the peaceful outlook of the last century. It was taken for granted that you listened to reason, that it was right and natural to do what your conscience told you to do. For a man to die by the hand of another was a rare and exceptional event, something quite out of the ordinary. Murders happened in plays, newspapers, and detective stories, not in everyday life. And it was then, with the coming of the war and the revolution, it was then that untruth came down on our land of Russia. The main misfortune, the root of all evil to come, was the loss of confidence in the value of one's own opinion. People imagine it was out of date to follow their own moral sense, and they must all sing in chorus and live by other people's notions, notions that were being crammed down everybody's throat. And then there arose the power of the glittering phrase, first the czarist, then the revolutionary. And this social evil became an epidemic. It was catching, and it affected everything. Nothing was left untouched by it. And our home, too, became infected. Something went wrong in it. Instead of being natural and spontaneous as we had always been, we began to be idiotically pompous with each other. Something showy, artificial, forced, crept into our conversation. You felt you had to be clever in a certain way about certain world-important themes. How could Pasha, her husband, who was so discriminating, so exacting with himself, who distinguished so unerringly between reality and appearance, how could he fail to notice the falsehood that had crept into our lives? And there you have this rara avis, this rare bird singing a strange, rare song in the midst of monolithic, collectivized, dictatorial, communist Russia. and all the brutalities that were practiced by the Bolshevik armies during the Civil War are depicted with the same frankness and the same sadness as those perpetrated by the White Guards of Kolchak. For these crimes, Boris Pasternak has been denounced by the Union of Soviet Writers, 800 of them, collectively. Most of them who had never read the book, because the book is not available in Russia altogether. They, his fellow writers, these men who should represent the conscience of a people, these intellectuals, they call this poetic mystic, this man who tried to tell the truth as he saw it, without hatred, without venom, they called him a pig and a traitor. And they demanded that he be expelled from the Soviet Union. And Boris Pasternak himself, who had at first accepted gladly and thankfully the Nobel Prize, was soon compelled to decline it, was soon compelled to write a pitiful letter to Khrushchev, asking that he be not forced out of his native land, for he was bound to Russia, as he put it, by his birth, his life, and work, and cannot visualize his fate away from his motherland. And he has been compelled to acknowledge his errors and his gross mistakes. I don't know what these errors could possibly be, but as anyhow, he was compelled to acknowledge them. Like those Russian revolutionist leaders who were compelled to acknowledge during those famous purge trials sins which they never committed. And this, of course, Khrushchev himself has stated to have been the case. Boris Pasternak had on earlier occasions, before he wrote Dr. Zhivago, been accused by his fellow writers as, and as they put it, an internal emigre of the ivory tower. Rather confused metaphor, but you get the idea. He was an emigre, he really didn't belong to Russia, this man who claims to be tied heart and soul with every life string of his to his motherland, that he's an emigre, and that he lives in an ivory tower. And all because he would not follow the party line. For a time, Boris Pasternak stopped writing altogether and contented himself with translating some of the works of the great Westerners like Shakespeare, Goethe, Shelley. And they say that his translations are the most perfect in Russian. I have no way of knowing. But when the thaw set in, soon after the death of Stalin, when Khrushchev at the 20th Congress of the Communists denounced Stalin for the crimes which he committed against groups and against individuals, for his needless suppression, some people in Russia began to feel that a new day had dawned, that the ice had begun to crack. They began to speak up. They thought that Khrushchev was serious about the things he said. But shortly thereafter, you remember, came the uprisings in Poland and the uprisings in Hungary. And immediately the ice froze up again. And these innocents, these poets and mystics were caught in this terrible freeze. They had spoken too soon and had taken Khrushchev's word on its face value. And now Dr. Zhivago is in deep trouble. And the free world cannot but sympathize with this man. We need not agree with everything that Pasternak says in his book. His whole outlook on life
his approach to the problems of life, is something that many of us would not subscribe to. There is too little of that social passion, which you find even in the writings of Tolstoy, which are not found in Dr. Zhivago. There is too much of the man living in the ivory tower. But one cannot help but sympathize with a man who speaks out of conviction, out of his deep thought and reflection in all honesty and in sincerity, and gives his comments on the world about him and what's happening to human beings who are caught in this vast turmoil and upheaval of a revolutionary era. I imagine that the best comment, and with that I shall close, that can be made upon what's happening to Dr. Boris Pasternak was made unintentionally by an American writer who himself joined the Communist Party, joined it rather late, in 1943, and after serving the party most faithfully and prostituting his art to the purposes and propaganda of his party, came to a sudden and shocking awareness after Mr. Khrushchev made that famous confession before the communists in Moscow that he had been wrong. And so Mr. Howard Fast, in his book, The Naked God, writes, and I will read you these few paragraphs, because they tell the whole story from the mouth of a writer, from the mouth of a man who tried to be a communist writer, and who, by the way, did not live in Moscow and was not subject to the direct, repressive, terroristic methods, but who lived in the United States. But even here, this monolithic machine of the party took hold of him and made him slavishly obedient to its dictates. He wrote, as he said, he compelled himself to write his books so that they would be safe books from the point of view of the communist, free from error, the kind of error that Pasternak has had to confess, and to obey the writ of the communist priesthood. And here it is. We who are writers have had a peculiar and singular experience with the Communist Party, and I have given you here a brief outline of my own. In that you have seen a strange development, and perhaps a terrifying one for people of imagination. One of the cardinal tenets of the Protestant Reformation was the recovery and redevelopment to new heights of the ancient Judaic prophetic creed, of the individual's responsibility to his own soul and to his own conscience, almost quoting the words of Dr. Zhivago, which I read a moment ago. The Jew, in his development of prophetic monotheism, and I talk here of social rather than religious evolution, put forth the concept of a covenant between man and his God. This covenant or contract is central to prophetic Judaism, and among other things, it places responsibility for his own actions squarely upon the individual, making matters of social responsibility things which he himself must decide and act upon, such decisions being lawful and acceptable in the eyes of God. And there is a long and proud history of revolution to mark man's stages through history and up the ladder of social evolution. But until the Bolshevik Revolution, each one of these stages exhibited a certain broadening of personal freedom. The Bolshevik Revolution, however,
specified a narrowing of personal freedom as a means towards the end of complete and ultimate personal freedom, a proposition developed in the theory of the dictatorship of the proletariat. The commissar then becomes the big brother. And his role, in the deeper sense, is to replace the responsibility of conscience. He predicates a situation where the very nature of right and wrong has changed, and he denies the further ability of the individual to distinguish right from wrong as a matter of conscience. In his final stage, he obliterates conscience and substitutes his holy writ as dispensed by his own priestly function. And the hellish nightmare that this can and must lead to is spelled out in Khrushchev's secret speech. For where the individual is robbed of conscience, the society of which he is a part must of necessity be robbed of both ethic and morality. The yardstick of judgment disappears, and right and wrong lose all historical meaning and significance. If there's any lesson for us in Dr. Zhivago and in the experiences of its author, it is this: we can't do very much about Russia. They will have to decide their own way of life, and ultimately their own attitude towards the right of the creative artist. The lesson for us is that we here at home safeguard, with every power that is in us, this right of freedom, of free speech, of thinking for ourselves, the right of conscience, the right of individual judgment, and to see to it that our conscience is well informed, and that our freedom of speech is responsible freedom of speech. That is our heritage, and that is our greatest contribution here to civilization.